So this will be a course on statistical mechanics, but more than on statistical mechanics, it will actually be a course on phase transitions. So that will be the main topic of the whole course. And so in the first part, I'll discuss them from a thermodynamic perspective, and then we will switch to a microscopic description, and you know, describe the microscopic theory of phase transitions. And then we will encounter some interesting techniques which will be useful to you also in quantum field theory, such as renormalization and stuff like that. So, I have given you this preliminary content of the course. And I hope to cover all the topics, and maybe you have noticed also that towards the end is this paragraph on quantum phase transitions. So that will be towards the end of the course, and it will be lectured by Denis, who is an expert on these things. So you know, we probably two lectures delivered on quantum phase transitions towards the end. Also, I randomly mentioned some books which may be of use, but not really. I really like the book on thermodynamics by Atkins. I think it's an excellent book, and I'll follow it today. And then there are some, you know, classic statistical mechanics references like Landau and Lifshitz or Patria. But main point of the course is really the critical phenomena and phase transitions. And so Goldenfeld is quite a nice book, although it will not be precisely how we will discuss it in this course. But it's a nice book to read, and it gives you the flavor of what's going on there. And Cardi is a nice book, and Brezin is quite concise, but also to the point. So, yeah, so it's some randomly books, but they won't be much of a use. And hopefully there'll be this statistical physics thing, PSI study text, which I'll hopefully update and put on the wiki, sometimes before the lecture, sometimes after the lecture, sometimes never. Okay. Questions, comments? Okay, if there are no questions and comments, then let me start with chapter one, which is preliminaries. And to get everyone on the same page, I really want to discuss basically the basics of thermodynamics, basics of statistical physics, and you know, how phase transitions appear in these descriptions. And then chapter two will be about microscopic description of phase transitions. And so let me start directly with review of thermodynamics. So thermodynamics is interested how various macroscopic properties actually relate to each other, how you can describe phenomena just using the microscopic properties without using any microscopic assumptions. So thermodynamics interrelate the macroscopic properties. So for example, you may talk about a volume, you may talk about pressure and stuff like that. And so it doesn't use any, no use of microscopic assumptions or description of the theory. Okay, and of course, that provides you some limits to thermodynamics, what it can give you, but at the same time it's very powerful because it doesn't really, you know, relate to any microscopic model, and rather it just uses some very general considerations which are almost always true no matter what the microscopic model is. And so to actually really do this, you need to introduce new quantities. So new quantities. If you, for example, talk about classical mechanics, then you talk about energies and stuff like that. But now if you want to switch to thermodynamics, you need some new quantities which describes your system. And so these are basically temperature, internal energy, anentropy. So we have three new quantities, and each of these quantities is basically introduced into the picture by a separate law. So whereas the temperature denoted by T corresponds to the zeroth law of thermodynamics, internal energy U is discussed by the first law, and entropy S is basically introduced by the second law. So you have three separate laws to introduce three new quantities, which will describe your things. Okay, so we will do that today. So I will basically review what these thermodynamic laws are and how these quantities are really introduced. By the way, you can also split thermodynamic variables into two kinds. So it's either intensive or extensive. So intensive quantities are such that they are local in character. And an example of an intensive quantity is, for example, the pressure, or if you want, for example, electric intensity and other things. So something which is really local in nature. Whereas extensive quantity measures the system as a whole. System describes the system as a whole. And typically this is something like volume, mass, internal energy, and something like that. So really, you know, if I split the system into two halves, the volume will change, the mass will change, the internal energy will change. If I split the system in two halves, it still has the same pressure at that point. Okay, and then you can also introduce quantities which are, so having an extensive quantity, you can make a specific extensive quantity, for example, small v, which is V over the number of particles. And so you are basically making an intensive one by taking an extensive one and dividing by the size of the system, or you know, per unit mass or something like that. So you can have specific heat for the whole system, but you can also have specific heat per kilogram of your substance or something like that. So you can make these specific quantities here. So now what is interesting about thermodynamic variables is that they appear in conjugate pairs, most of them. So these are described by conjugate pairs. And so conjugate pairs are such that their product has units of energy. So for example, pressure and volume. If you multiply pressure by volume, you get something which has units of energy, temperature, and entropy, and other things, tension, and area. So all these things have actually, they are thermodynamically conjugate quantities, and their product is actually have units of energy. So now another important concept is what a thermodynamic equilibrium is. And so let me define it in a very sneaky way. So thermodynamic equilibrium
which one are the last two
values? Temperature, entropy, surface tension, and area. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's denoted by sigma or, depends on. So you will say that the thermodynamic equilibrium corresponds to a state of a system where no further changes take place. So basically, if you, you know, have a system and you wait sufficiently long enough so that it does whatever it needs to do, it will be in thermodynamic equilibrium. Okay. So as a subset of thermodynamic equilibrium, you can have thermal equilibrium. So thermal equilibrium, it's a subset of thermodynamic equilibrium where you basically only allow the system to exchange heat, but you don't allow the system to do any work. So for example, you can have one gas which has some pressure here, and another gas which has much bigger pressure here. But if you separate them by a wall which cannot move, and you only allow them to exchange heat, then they will be in thermal equilibrium, but they won't be in thermodynamic equilibrium, because if you remove this wall, something will happen again. Okay, so thermal equilibrium is a subset of that, and so basically no exchange of work is allowed. So that's what thermodynamic equilibrium is. Now, certain processes can be reversible processes, and that's very important. So a process, reversible process, is such a process that you can basically reverse what happened by an infinitesimal change in the conditions. So can be reversed by an infinitesimal change in conditions. So for example, if I apply a pressure on my gas system, the gas system can push back and, you know, return back to the same position. If that is the case, then you call such process a reversible process. If something wrong happens and you never go back to the initial condition, to the initial position, then it's irreversible. Okay. And so there are basically two conditions when your process is reversible. And so reversible means quasi-static and no hysteresis. So what quasi-static means is if you go from one position to another, basically the system has all the time to equilibrate through the way. So, you know, any state which is intermediate to the state of the initial and final position can be thought of as in thermodynamic equilibrium. So quasi-static basically means slow enough, so that you always have equilibrium in the meantime. Okay? And no hysteresis means that basically, you know, no bad things happen. So really, for example, there's this example of magnetization or something. So if you start magnetizing, you go like this way. But if you suddenly want to return back, you don't go back the same way, but rather you go a different way. And it's called hysteresis. So what it actually means is that some of the state which you were previously in is actually a metastable state. It's not a stable one, but it's a metastable one. So you could be there for some time, but actually, you know, once you start shuffling with this state, you never go back. So this is like long-lived metastable states. States are not allowed if you want to have a reversible process. Okay. Questions? Yes.
Doesn't that hysteresis fall under quasi-static? Because if you were
So if you want, yes. well, this can be slow enough. Can be slow enough process, but basically, you know, there's some. there's some, you know, the metastable state is due some inhomogeneities in your iron or something like that, and I know they can live for a long time. So yeah, well, but yeah, it's like a local. It's locally stable, not globally. And then you can stay there for some time. Yeah. And you can do it slowly, but it's not slow enough in some sense. But anyway, so reversible processes are important, and if you can go there and go back, that's what is reversible. And that's what is important for us. Okay, so these are the basic concepts in thermodynamics. So now let me start really doing these zeros and first and second laws to introduce what a temperature is, what the internal energy is, and what the entropy is. And we will use these concepts in statistical physics later on, and they will be derived in completely different fashion. But basically, anyway, there will be this connection with thermodynamics, so it's good to know what these things are in thermodynamics. Okay, so thermodynamic laws. And let me start with the zeroth one, the zeroth law. And basically, it's like a preparation of your stage. So you say, if two systems are separately in thermal equilibrium with a third one, then they must be also in thermal equilibrium with each other. So let me write it down. If two systems are separately in thermal equilibrium, with a third, they must be also in thermal equilibrium with each other. Okay, so that's what a zeroth law is. So basically, what you are saying is that you can use the third system as a thermometer, and it will show the same temperature for all the bodies which are in thermal equilibrium. Okay, but you can do slightly better if you use gas thermometry. Okay, so experiment. And you will use gas thermometry. So now if you have a gas system, its state is usually determined by just two quantities, by the pressure of the gas and by the volume of the gas. So that's the normal situation. So really, to specify the state of the gas system, I need to specify P and V, and that's enough. However, if you require that this gas system is in thermal equilibrium with another system, then actually only one of them is sufficient to know. So let's say I need to know only pressure, and the volume is already fixed by requiring that this guy is actually in thermal equilibrium with another one. Okay, so now let's use this so gas thermometry. So if in thermal equilibrium with some other system, state of gas, is fixed by only one of P or V. So I can specify only one of them, and the other one be already fixed. And that's an experimental fact, and you know, okay. So So now let's use, you know, let's have three systems. And let's assume that, you know, system one is in equilibrium with system three, system two is in equilibrium with system three, and then the zero law gives us that also one and two are in equilibrium. Okay, so let's use that. So, because one and three are in equilibrium, and two and three are in equilibrium, it must be the case that there is some function f1 which relates the pressure of one and the volume of one and pressure of three and volume of three, so that if I, you know, fix this system here, I fix system three, and I, let's say, fix P1, I already know what V1 is, so this must be equal to zero. So there must be, you know, this relation which relates P1 to V1 in this way. At the same time, there must be another function F2 which relates two and three, so P2 and V2 and P3 and V3, and this must be equal to zero. Okay, so we have this second relation. So now, having these guys, I can solve each of them, let's say, for P3. So using the first relation, I'll have P3 is P3, and now it's function of P1, V1, and V3. And at the same time, I can solve for P3 also from this relation. So I'll have P3 is P3 of P2, V2, and V3. Okay, so I can, you know, solving for P3, I can solve these relations like that. Okay, but of course these have to be the same, right? So I can put an equality in between them. So I have that P3, P1, and V3 must be equal to a different relation, P2, V2, and V3. Okay, so this must be true. And you know, this is something, that is something, and I can use it to solve for something else. So now I can express from this, let's say, what P1 is. So this is if and only if P1 is only a function of V1, V3, and P2, and V2. P1 is a function of V1, V3, V2, and P2. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I must have that. Okay. So far we have just used the fact that one is in equilibrium with three and two is in equilibrium with three. So now let's use the fact, given by the zero's law, that also one and two are in equilibrium. So zero's law, now one and two are in equilibrium. That means that there must be some function S3 relating one and two, so P1, V1 and P2 and V2 is equal to zero. I can use this relation to solve for P1 as well. Okay, so P1 is a function now of V1, V2 and P2. Okay, haha. So now let's compare what we got from here and what we got previously. Okay, so by comparing these things, you see that they are, you know, almost the same, except this guy seemingly depends on V3, but this one tells you it cannot, right? So V3 has to drop out of this equation, so cannot depend on if the zero's law is actually true, right? So V3 has to drop out. But of course, this thing here is completely equivalent to this relation here. That means that V3 has to drop out of these relations as well. So V3 actually is not here. Okay. So by the zero's law. So what do you conclude? That P3 So from here, it follows that P3 is actually looking at this relation of function only of P1 and V1. Or it's a function of P2 and V2. But V3 cannot appear there. Okay. But of course, P1 and V1 is one system, and P2 and V2 is another system, and they have nothing to do with each other. I can field specify P1 and V1 and P2 and V2 in some sense. So this must be equal to a constant. And let's call it theta, which is a constant. In this case, it's independent of which system I'm considering. And that's what's called empirical temperature. So really, the Zero's Law gives you a notion how to define something which you will call a temperature by really requiring just these things, plus the experimental evidence or experimental fact, which I used here, that really, if I have something in equilibrium, it's only one quantity which specifies my state. Yes?
What do you mean by defining a temperature in units of pressure?
Well, V3. Very good. So this is a constant. This is a constant. I will have to specify the right pressure, the right units. But yeah, if I specify the right units, I can say it corresponds to a temperature. Yeah. See, it's good. Yeah. This P3. Yeah, this is a stupid notation. Sorry for that. But anyway, what it means is you can introduce this is equal to a constant. If you have the right units, then you would have something like empirical temperature. But yes, you can measure empirical temperature in terms of pressure. So this has nothing to do with real temperature. It is something that you really you can assign to the system and measures, you know, things like that.
Is there a reason to call it temperature?
It's an empirical temperature. Something which you can measure by experiment, but it has nothing to do with the real temperature. We will introduce real temperature in a minute. So,
right. I mean, is there a reason to call temperature instead of just pressure?
Well, it's a quantity which is constant for all these substances, right? And so you call it empirical temperature. It doesn't have to be temperature. Yeah, maybe that's a better answer. So it doesn't have to even write the right units. It's something which is really a constant for all these systems of gases. And you call it empirical temperature, although it doesn't have to be. Okay, that's better. Was there another question? Okay. Very good. So now, of course, this thing here would also, so once you are relating, you know, a temperature with other properties of the gas, like, say, pressure and volume, this relation is called equation of state. So this thing is called equation of state. So we have Zero's Law. Now, what is first law? The first law. Okay, in some sense, the first law is tautological in the same way as Newton's law is. So you use Newton's law to define not only what a force is, but also what a mass of the system is. So you are basically by one relation, you are defining two quantities by saying, yeah, force is something, you know, mass is something, resistance with respect to the force, if I want to get acceleration, but force is something which causes the acceleration. So you are defining two quantities by the Newton's law in some sense. But in the same way, you'll be defining in the first law two quantities. You'll be defining heat, and you'll be defining what internal energy is. Okay, but you can do it a clever way, as in the Newton's case as well. And so basically you say first, if I have thermally isolated system, of course thermally isolated means there is no heat, so you need to know what heat is. But anyway, if you have thermally isolated system, then the statement is there exists a function of state which you call internal energy, and denoted by U, such that you can change this internal energy by doing work on the system. So it's work on the system.
Can we clarify again how in the system how we're specifying a state? Still by pressure and volume only, or?
So state is something which completely specifies your system. Of course, the internal energy, because you, for example, for gas, you know that it's enough to specify pressure and volume.
Sure.
Then the internal energy has to be function of these two.
Sure.
Yeah. For ideal gas, it's only that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but.
So what I mean by
in general to specify a state, how many parameters do I need?
It's a good question. So how many degrees of freedom there are in some sense?
So we're not specifying that just yet. But.
No. So what I mean, a function of state, it here in this definition is that basically, really what stands here is a total differential. So let's say I have a system which goes in some parameter space from one point to another point, and what I'm saying is that. If that I can prescribe some internal energy at in one state, and I can prescribe to the system internal energy in another state, and then by meaning that it's a function of state, I mean no matter which way I go from this one point to another point, I will have always the same internal energy here. So what I'm saying here is that this guy is a total differential. In some sense, if there is no heat. Okay? So basically, thermal isolated system, you can change the state only by work because you basically forbid to exchange heat and exchange, things like that. So the only thing which you can do is you can work on the system, and then I'm saying, no matter how I work, as long as I go to the same final configuration, I'll have the same internal energy. That's what I mean, functional state. Okay. So this is for thermal isolated system. Of course, not every system is thermal isolated, and so in that case, so if not. Thermally isolated. It is an experience that you can also change the internal energy. For example, even without doing any work, but for example by exchanging heat with your surroundings. And in that case, your first law takes the following form: dU is delta Q. Plus delta V, where this thing is again work on the system, this thing is heat transfer to the system, heat transferred to the system. And this guy is how this function of state changes. So now notice that I have put here different d. So here is really d denoting total differential. Here is delta and delta, meaning that these guys are not function of state. So it's just something, some infinitesimal small change. So I have done some little work here. I've transferred a little heat here, but they are not total differentials. So basically, when you have not isolated systems, you cannot. So if you just do work alone, it's not a total differential. If you do the heat alone, it's not a total differential. Only their sum is. Only their sum changes the state of the system. So, yeah. So for example, I could, so if I allow to change the heat, I would have to say, you know, if I want to do it by work alone, I would have to say, I have to take this path now. And so I would have to specify some other parameters to specify I'm going this path here. Okay. So now we have this relation, this more general one. And it's nothing else than conservation of energy. So basically, historically, the first law marks the fact that heat was recognized as some form of energy, right? So now I have total energy equals to heat plus work. Heat is another form of energy. And this is nothing else than conservation of energy, this law. So now, by convention, you can use this to define what hotter and what colder means. And you say that heat flows from hotter to colder. So if you place two systems in thermal contact and you don't do anything, then there may be some heat exchange. And then by definition, you call such a body hotter if actually delta Q is positive and flows to the other one. Okay, so this is the definition of hotter and colder. So now I haven't told you what delta V could be. But of course, you know that from mechanics and you know that from many other things. So you have many examples what a work term might look like. But the most typical one in thermodynamics is the one done by hydrostatic pressure. So if you have pressure, it pushes on your on the system with volume V. It actually changes the volume. It makes the system smaller. And this is the work done by this pressure. Similarly, you can have work done by this surface tension. And this is given by surface tension times change in the area of the surface. So these are examples of what this work term here might be. Questions? Yeah?
I have a question. Why does one relation have plus sign and the other minus?
Which one? Well, I really, you know, if I'm trying to compress the gas, so dV of my gas is negative. So this thing will become positive, so I'm really doing work. This one here, if I'm making, what is it? So the surface tension is trying to make the surface smaller. So if I'm trying to make it bigger, I have to work against the tension. And so if I'm making the surface bigger, I'll have positive sign there. Okay, so we have some kind of temperature, and we have conservation of energy. So now real thermodynamics starts with the second law. That's where the fun begins. So let's formulate second law. And second law basically states that, you know, no matter if the first law is satisfied and if you have some processes which are energetically possible, not all of them actually happen in nature. Some of them, so you have some sort of irreversibility in the nature. And even if the energy is conserved, then still this process cannot happen. So the second law you know, corresponds to very approximately to irreversibility. Of nature. But also to, you know, way how to characterize efficiency, how you can transfer heat to work and the other way around. And so these are intimately connected. So also efficiency of processes. So once you start about talking about efficiency of processes and, you know, how much work I can extract from a heat bath and, you know, and stuff like that, there is this very useful concept of a heat engine. And of course, heat engine is an idealized device which, by definition, have to work in cycles. And so has to return after each cycle to an initial position, because otherwise it's not repeatable. So you want something that is repeatable, and, you know, in each cycle I get back to my initial position. Has to return back to initial state after each cycle. And so, you know, once you have such an engine, so it may look like that. So I have my engine here. And in principle, this engine may absorb some heat. Let's say Q1, that's the absorbed heat. It may do some work for us, which is what we want after all. But it actually, as you will see, has to also reject some heat. Otherwise, actually, the second law will not work. So this is what you mean by heat engine. So it absorbs heat, rejects heat, and does some work for us. Okay, so now you define efficiency of this engine and you call it eta. And of course, what you are interested in is how much work you can get out of this. So work out. And then a bad thing here is that you have to provide some heat to it. So heat in. In other words, this is W over Q1. But I am consistent with the first law, so I have to preserve the energy. So of course, W is Q1 minus Q2. So this is 1 minus Q2 over Q1. So that's the efficiency of my heat engine here. Okay. So among all these heat engines, there is particularly a nice one, which is called Carnot's engine. So the Carnot engine. And so the Carnot engine is a special engine which works as follows. So if I have my PV diagram, then it works in cycles where each cycle looks like this. So first, I start at point A, and I go to point B on an isotherm, on this empirical temperature isotherm. So I go from A to B, and I absorb some heat Q1 in that process while moving on that constant temperature. So I'm expanding, you know, at the same temperature, absorbing Q1. Then, so this is an isotherm, there is another isotherm. Then I go on adiabatic, meaning no heat exchange. So now I still keep expanding, but now I don't allow any heat to be transferred. So I go to point C here. And then I go back. So and I go to point D while emitting some heat Q2, and then again on the adiabatic, I go to point A, not exchanging any heat. So now, if you look at this picture, and there's this area in between here, and that's nothing else than the work which is actually extracted in each such cycle. So this is a specific example of a heat engine which works that first isotherm, then adiabatic, then isotherm, then adiabatic. And this is the work I can extract in each of such cycles. Okay? So it's a very special engine. And so what is actually interesting and very important property of this engine is that it is reversible. So in some sense, you can always, you know, turn it around and go this way, okay, by instead of rejecting this Q2, actually absorbing this Q2, and then going here and rejecting the Q1. And of course, this will be at the expense of the work done, which is this W. So I can now, you know, do some work, reverse this thing, and pump, you know, extract energy from Q2 and put energy up there. Okay, so this thing actually can be done reversibly. Okay, so that's what Carnot engine is. So now, understanding these concepts, we can formulate what a second law is. So let me do it. And let me have two formulations of the second law, which are completely equivalent, as I'll show you, almost show you. So second law and so let's first have Kelvin. So he said no process is possible result is the complete conversion of heat into work. So in other words, the second law tells you if I have that engine there and I'm absorbing Q1 and working out W, then Q2 is non-zero, says you. Okay, so I cannot really transform heat into work only. So that's one formulation of the second law. Another one is due to Clausius. And again, no process is possible. Salt result is the transfer of heat from a colder hotter body. Okay, so two formulations. So I cannot, you know, take heat from cold body and put it into hot body unless basically I do some work. Okay, so these are the two formulations. So now let me show that they are sort of equivalent by pictures. So let me see. So for example, let's assume that Clausius is violated. So if Clausius is violated, I can indeed transfer heat from cold to hot. So I have hot here, I have cold here, and then I can have engine one, which would actually take the heat here and put it here. So if Clausius is violated, I can construct this, Q1 and then Q2. So now, well, this will be possible. Now you take a normal engine. Normal heat engine, which works in the usual way. So you have hot again and cold again. And then you have the engine two. And you arrange that it actually extracts the same heat Q1 here as this one, but now the other way around. So it extracts Q1 from hot body, puts Q2 here, and does some work, Q1 minus Q2 here, like that. So that will be a normal engine. And the only thing which I really have to tune is that this heat Q1 is the same as that heat Q2, as this heat Q1 here. One is going up, one is going down. So now if you construct them and put them together, then of course what happens is that something strange is happening here. Well, okay. Sorry for that. So I'll have Q1 here. Okay. Sorry for that. So I want to cancel this one here. So I want to put Q2 here. But this one can be anything. So it's Q3 minus Q2. I did it the other way around. So now if I put them together, this heat exchange and that heat exchange actually is zero. So this is the same as a machine going from hot and cold, which is, so it's now machine three, which is doing Q3 minus Q1 and does some work, which is Q3 minus Q1, but doesn't put anything into the cold one. But of course, so now you have a machine which extracts heat from one bath and makes an equivalent work here. Okay, so now of course this is in contradiction with Kelvin. So this contradicts Kelvin. So we have shown if Clausius is not true, then Kelvin is not true. And you can go the other way around basically the same way. Okay, so the two formulations of the second law are equivalent.
So you still have to show it. You can make it such that Q3 does not equal
Q1. Yeah, sure. But yeah. In principle, I can have any machine here. And the only thing is that really I have to assume that these are the same. And then you can do it. You can do it. Hopefully. Okay. So we have two formulations of the second law, and you can use whichever one you like better. So now, having these, I can formulate the most narcissistic theorem ever in physics, which is Carnot's theorem. And it's really self-centered theorem, so you will see immediately why. So now, from the second law, it follows Carnot's theorem. And that basically says, no engine. Rating. Between two given reservoirs I have one reservoir at temperature T1, another at T2. So now you have an engine which operates in between these two. And so the statement is no engine operating between these two reservoirs is more efficient than my engine. Okay? So no engine can be more efficient than Carnot's engine. And of course, he formulated his theorem. So basically, you know, he was saying, you know, no matter how hard you try, you cannot do better than I do. And that's, of course, yeah. If you can prove that, it's perfect, right? So you will prove this in today's tutorial. Yeah? And it's a statement which follows from this second law. You can use whichever formulation you like, and you will do it in today's tutorial with some help. But so this is very self-centered and, you know, very narcissistic theorem. But actually, it has an unpleasant consequence for Carnot. So unpleasant consequence and that says that all reversible engines operating between these two reservoirs, operating two reservoirs. Are equally efficient. Okay, so that's, well, the first theorem looks very good for Carnot, right? So basically, nobody can build a better machine than I did. But the second one tells, well, no matter how you build your machine, actually, they will be all equivalent efficient. If they are reversible. So reversibility of this thing is a very important thing. And what it means is this: if I go, for example, in the Carnot cycle, I can go this way, or I can go the other way. And that means what reversibility is. So as long as I can run my machine the other way around as well, then they are all equally efficient. OK? So now, why we bother with these theorems? OK, maybe here. Questions? Is that, you know, having these theorems, in particular the corollary or this unpleasant consequence, it actually allows you to construct what a true temperature is. So what a thermodynamic temperature, not an empirical one, which is good only for, you know, the system of my gases, which I considered before, but what really true thermodynamic temperature is. And the statement goes as follows. So this latter thing means that if you look at the efficiency of the engine, so eta is 1 minus Q2 over Q1. OK, so 1 doesn't really matter. But if you look at Q2 over Q1, or better, so from here it follows that if I take Q1 over Q2, then no matter how I build my reversible machine, this will be independent of that. So the only thing it can depend on is actually the empirical temperatures of my hotter and colder reservoir. So this must be a function of theta 1 and theta 2, but this must be the same function for all reversible machines. So this must be a universal function. Function, some concrete function which is true for all these machines which are reversible machines. And it can depend only on two things, only on the properties of the reservoirs, theta 1 and theta 2. Okay. So now this is very good because you can, for example, use Carnot machine or any other reversible machine, but let's use the Carnot machine and let's do it in between three reservoirs. So you have theta 1 and then you have theta 2 and finally you have theta 3. And so first Carnot will just absorb Q1, return Q2 and do some work, Q1 minus Q2. And the second one, let it consume Q2 again. This is my Carnot 2, and rejects Q3, and does some work, Q2 minus Q3. Okay. But by that thing, I must have that Q1 over Q2 over Q2 is a function of theta 1 and theta 2. It's going from here to there. Going from here to there, I must have that Q2 over Q3 is a function of theta 2 and theta 3. But of course, I can, you know, put C1 and C2 together. So then the absorbed is Q1 and the rejected is Q3. So I can have Q1 over Q3 must be function of theta 1 and theta 3. Okay, so I have all these three equalities. So now I can multiply the first Q1, Q2. So I can multiply these two together. So I have Q1 over Q3 is f of theta 1, theta 2, and f of theta 2 and theta 3. So if I multiply the first two, but it must be equal to f of theta 1 and theta 3. Okay, so now it's a mathematics problem. So which universal function satisfies that, you know, this property here? And the answer is surprisingly simple. F must be theta 1 over theta 2. So F theta 1 theta 2 is something theta 1 something theta 2. And if this is true, then that equation will be true. And I'm happy. Of course, now this new quantity T, you call the absolute thermodynamic temperature. So T is thermodynamic temperature. And you see, it's some function of my empirical temperature theta. Okay, so this is how you introduce the true thermodynamic temperature by really, you know, using this Carnot's theorem. Okay, so now we have that our efficiency. So first of all, what it means is that Q1 over Q2 is T1 over T2. If I say that T of theta 1 is T1 and T of theta 2 is T2, so I have that. And at the same time, my efficiency of my reversible thing is 1 minus T2 over T1. That's the efficiency of any reversible engine working between two reservoirs at theta 1 and theta 2. Okay, so now we have temperature, the true temperature. Hmm. questions? Okay, so the last thing which we are missing is the entropy. So let's go for the entropy.
Know that f is just t divided t of theta 1 divided by t of theta 2?
Well, it's a mass property, so you can try searching for other functions which satisfy
exponential.
Does it?
You can rewrite them as ratios. I'm speaking about that too, but if you have e to the theta 1 minus theta 2 is e to the theta 1 property.
Ah, so
it's just a...
Now, how do you rewrite
that? Well, okay.
Okay, your homework. Okay, so we want to introduce the entropy, and for that we first notice that we can play with these efficiencies, and this is done by Clausius again the work, but because no engine can be more efficient than the Carnot engine. And the Carnot engine has the efficiency eta just 1 minus T2 over T1, then we have that efficiency of any engine is smaller than efficiency of the Carnot engine. In other words, 1 minus Q2 over Q1 is smaller or equal to 1 minus T2 over T1, which is the efficiency of Carnot. Okay, so now 1 cancels, and it's a non-trivial thing, which I spent half an hour doing that. You find that Q1 over T1 minus Q2 over T2 is small or equal than zero. So going from here to there, that took me half an hour. Or more generally, you can say that sum over Qi over Ti is small or equal than zero when you accept the convention that heat is positive. Heat is positive, if it enters the system. So if it's rejected, you take negative. If it's entering the system, you take positive, and then this must be true. Or for any engine working in a cycle, an integral version of this is true, and that's Clausius' theorem. So it says that for any closed cycle of the engine, we have that delta Q over T is smaller than or equal to zero, and the equality happens if the engine is reversible. Okay, so I haven't proved this, but of course it looks like a trivial generalization of what I wrote down here. There, right? So, yeah, it's sort of believable that this must be true. Okay, so what is the entropy? So now you define the entropy as whatever stands here, but only when there is this equality sign, so only when you have reversible things. So you define the entropy by saying that ds is delta Q of reversible cycles, of reversible change of heat over T. And that's a definition. And you can show, so if I have reversible here, I have equality here. So again, going from one point to another point, no matter which way I go, I'll find the same entropy. As long as, you know, delta Q is reversible. As I'm going from one to two, I can go any, I can take any path. But by this Clausius theorem, I have equality, which means that if I go around the whole thing here, I get zero, which means this thing must be equal to that thing, no matter which way I go. Right? So S, again, here, so S is again a function of state. And really, this D here is a total differential. Have the entropy now. And if you look at this relation here, well, it also tells you what temperature is. And some, you know, physicists like this definition of the entropy. Well, say they say the temperature, the thermodynamic temperature, is just an integrating factor of what you have to do to delta Q to get a total differential. So I take delta Q, I multiply by something, and I call that something 1 over temperature if it gives me the total differential. And so that's sometimes, you know, how the temperature is introduced in thermodynamics. Okay, so now if I don't have reversible change, but if I have irreversible change, so irreversible, or more specifically, let me consider I go from A to B, let's say there, I go irreversibly, and back, I go reversibly. Okay? So of course, the whole cycle is now irreversible because part of it is irreversible, so I cannot have checked irreversible to reversible. Okay, so let's consider this thing. And then by Clausius' theorem, you know that this thing here must be smaller than zero. So integral from A to B of delta Q over T plus integral from B to A delta Q reversible over T. And okay, it's actually, well, whatever, smaller or equal than zero. Well, it's actually smaller. So now you can put this guy here on the other side. Okay.